as I was lying down and not able to wipe them away. I had to ask someone to wipe them for me. It was amazing. The most amazing thing. It was like being born again. It was like being free.
Part 4. Threeps.
Summer Zapata, author, The Silent Revolution, Technology in the Wake of Hayden's Syndrome.
The development and rapid production and installation of the neural networks was obviously the first big event in the technological history of Hayden's. We spent what some not incorrectly felt was an appalling amount of money and arguably abandoned medical morality to develop the networks, but at the end of the day, it got done. The proof of concept was there, and suddenly, 24 companies, some established, some startups, were in the neural network business. But the neural networks were only a partial solution. The networks gave Hayden's sufferers their ability to communicate again with the outside world, but their bodies still didn't work. They still couldn't move. They were still trapped. And in many ways, they were still terribly isolated. The federal government threw billions into medical research trying to get brains to talk to the voluntary nervous system or to grow new nerve connections, but none of that was progressing at a rate that anyone was considering satisfactory. This opened the door to a left-field solution that absolutely no one saw coming.
Rebecca Warner, Chairwoman, Sebring Warner, Inc.
Charlie Sebring and I knew each other growing up, but not all that well, since he was a class behind me in school, and we ran in different circles. I was the stereotypical student government type, and he was a classic nerd. When I graduated, I went to Brown, and he went to Rensselaer, and I didn't see him again until the summer before my senior year, when he and I both interned at Greenwave, which my father owned. I got an internship in management, while Charlie was down in engineering. Until I caught him making things in the printers, I pretty much didn't have any contact with him. My internship was mostly just for show, because I was the owner's daughter, and we all know how that goes. On one hand, I was irritated with this, because by this time I knew I wanted to run a company, and I didn't like people thinking I wasn't a serious person. On the other hand, I wasn't really a serious person at the time, and I spent most of my time planning my summer evenings. So I couldn't complain that they gave me a bunch of chumpy tasks that a monkey could do. One of the chores I had to do was to prepare a weekly efficiency report for the Greenwave's printers. Greenwave handled a lot of bespoke production jobs for design studios and small manufacturers. Everyone has their own printers, but they weren't designed for large object jobs or jobs that required more than a couple of dozen copies made. Greenwave manufactured industrial-scale printers and also kept a manufacturing wing open to handle work from other companies. Our printers were good, but they were finicky and prone to breaking down. So we tracked their efficiency, and every week I compiled a report for the CTO. It was dead simple, especially since each of the printers imported their data into a spreadsheet automatically. All I really had to do was press a button to print it out. So every week I printed them out. Most weeks I didn't look at them, but one evening I was out with friends and remembered that I forgot to do the spreadsheet, and I didn't want to be known as so inept that I couldn't even do that. So I left the party early, 11 p.m., and went back to the office to run off the report. As I was collating the paper, I actually looked at the report and noticed one printer had a weird usage pattern. It usually went off shift at 10 p.m., which was the end of our second shift, but every day in the last week it was active between 11 p.m. and midnight. So I pulled up the real-time monitor and saw the printer was running right at that moment. I went down to the printer floor to see what was going on, and there was Charlie, printing out something that looked like a hand. He looked very surprised to see me. Naturally, I asked him what he was doing. He said he was doing some last-minute client work, so I said, fine, so show me the work order. We didn't do anything at Greenwave without a work order. Then Charlie got a panicked look in his eye, and that's when I realized whatever he was doing, he wasn't supposed to be doing it. So I decided to get tough with him and told him that he could either tell me what he was doing or he could tell his boss the next morning, with me providing the spreadsheet as incriminating documents. Charlie gave in and told me he was making a prototype. "Great," I said. "A prototype of what?" And he explained that he had been following the development of the neural networks they were making for the Hayden syndrome people, and realized that even if they got the networks to function, people would still be stuck in bodies that didn't move. He was building a machine that would integrate with the networks so that people would be able to walk and move and get out in the world. I asked him to tell me more, and we spent the next 5 hours going over everything. Greenwave had access to the Hayden Research Database because we contracted with GE for elements of their neural networks, and Charlie had been keeping up with the neural network development. A lot of research money was going into biological solutions to fixing Hayden bodies, but almost nothing for machine solutions. The closest thing was an old design of a scooter with a large tablet sticking up on a post. It gave minimal mobility, but no ability to hold or grasp objects or interact with people in a way that didn't feel like, well, you were a scooter with a tablet on it. What Charlie was prototyping was much better. An actual body with touch input, shaped like a human body and with all a body's capabilities. It was a robot, but instead of a robot brain, it had a human brain controlling it. It would be a new body. One that wouldn't get tired or ever get sick like the Hayden's victims' own bodies would. Charlie kept going on, and I honestly didn't understand more than about 20% of what he was saying. But when he was done, I did two things. The first thing I did was I went and put that spreadsheet through the shredder. The second thing I did was go into my dad's office the next morning and told him I wanted every penny of my trust fund right now, and if he didn't give it to me, I would tell Mom about his affair. And his other affair, too. When Dad agreed to that, I immediately rented the use of the printer Charlie had been working on. Then I marched down to the printer floor and told Charlie to quit his internship. He and I were going into business, full partners. And he did. I took a picture of the two of us right after to commemorate the moment. He looked dazed, like he just got hit by a truck.
Summer Zapata.
On paper, Charlie Sebring and Rebecca Warner didn't look like they should work together at all. She was extroverted, aggressive, and business-oriented, and he was classically introverted and focused on the project, almost to the exclusion of ordinary bodily functions. There's a rumor that one day Warner came into their office and poured a gallon jug of water over his head as a hint that he should go home and take a shower. The one thing they had in common was a commitment to the vision of what they started calling personal transports. Sebring saw the practical need and had enough rigor as an engineer not to let his design wander off into the thickets. If you look at his first set of prototypes, they were, from a design point, ruthlessly robotic. All function and no aesthetic. He wanted Hayden's patients to be able to move. He didn't care what they looked like as they did. Warner handled all the rest of it. She kept up with the business end of the Hayden Research Initiative Act and worked to exploit the gaping hole where the personal transports would eventually go. Warner's congressman was on the HRIA budgeting committee. She flew into D.C. personally to lobby him to allocate funds to biological solutions to Hayden paralysis rather than mechanical solutions. She knew that if federal funding started actively moving into her field, that the project she was funding out of her own trust fund was going to get swamped. And it worked. That year's HRIA allocations were heavy on biology and very light on mechanics. It helped that several very large pharmaceutical companies were also lobbying heavily for biological solutions, of course. But Warner's personal touch didn't hurt. Warner also handled the aesthetic aspects of the personal transports, driving Sebring to make them as attractive as possible before they showed them to the world. She was also the one who devised the company's publicity masterstroke.
Rebecca Warner.
They call it a publicity masterstroke, but what it really was paying attention. The two most famous Haydens in the world were, in order, Margaret Hayden and Chris Shane, Marcus Shane's toddler. They were also the two most well-connected Haydens, since once the networks were approved for general use among Haydens, they were very likely going to be two of the first people fit with them. Which meant, honestly speaking, that if we wanted to show off our wares, it made sense to work with them. So I told Charlie to make two very specific prototypes, one designed specifically for Margaret Hayden and one specifically for Chris Shane. I wanted them ready for when both had their networks installed. The first Margaret Hayden prototype, Charlie took things too literally and tried to make it look like Margaret Hayden, including a representation of her face. It was creepy. There's a concept called the uncanny valley, in which something that's almost but not quite human is repulsive because you're so very aware of it being fake. This was that. I pulled him away from that direction and gave him some design points. In particular, I pointed him at the female android from a very old film called Metropolis and suggested he use that as a starting point, although he should probably dial back the overt sexuality. Margaret Hayden's public image was fit and healthy, not sexpot. It took him 6 tries, but he got it. Chris Shane, he got in 1. Children are easy. I had developed a good relationship with Ohio District 8 U.S. Representative Ed Curtis because of his position on the House HRIA committee, and I knew that he and President Hayden were friendly, so I asked him to call in 1 favor from the president. He was skeptical, but I eventually convinced him. Ed came through, and Charlie and I got an audience with President Hayden, where we showed him photos of the personal transport and video of it in action, being remote piloted by Charlie, and told him that a prototype was ready for the First Lady, tuned to the type of neural network I knew she had in her head. What we hoped for was that he would be interested and that we might be able to show the prototype to him as part of a process to getting whatever approval we needed to have the First Lady to eventually use it. But after we explained the thing to him, he looked at me and Charlie and said, "Is it here?" Meaning the prototype. And it was, since we had put it in the back of a rented panel van that we drove from Ohio. So we told him so. Then he asked, "Is it ready?" Which took me a minute to realize that he was asking whether the First Lady could use it now, as in that minute. I had no idea how to answer that. I wasn't expecting that question. President Hayden stopped looking at me and looked at Charlie, who, bless his clueless heart, said, "It should be, sure." 5 hours later, we were in the West Bedroom, where the First Lady's body and medical team were, prepping the prototype to sync with her neural network.
Janice Massey.
I thought it was a bad idea. The President's Chief of Staff thought it was a bad idea. Mario Schmidt, head of the Presidential Secret Service Detail, nearly had a stroke trying to argue the President out of it. But the President wouldn't be talked out of it. The only person who possibly could have talked him out of it was Margie herself, but she was willing, although it seemed to me more for her husband's sake than her own. The personal transport was wheeled in on a gurney, along with a power source on a second gurney. I asked how it was supposed to work, and Charlie Sebring said that pretty much all the First Lady had to do was connect the thing to her internal network, and then it would be under her control. Mario made a final objection that the personal transport could be dangerous or introduce viruses to the First Lady's neural network. Rebecca Warner said, more than a little peremptorily, that she and Charlie Warner would be absolutely stupid to try to give a First Lady a virus in the White House, where the Secret Service could shoot them both dead at point-blank range. As I said, peremptorily, but she also had a point. They got it all set up, and then Charlie Sebring said to Margie that she could connect any time she wanted. A minute later, the personal transport gave a little twitch and a jerk, and then raised its hand close to its face as if looking at it. Then it stepped out of the gurney it was on, and everyone took a step back. The personal transport walked over to the mirror in the room and stood at it for a good minute, just looking. Then, in a very Margie Hayden move, it looked over its shoulder at the president and spoke, clearly, in a voice that sounded just like Margie's always did.
Rebecca Warner.
I remember it. She said, "I look just like C-3PO," which, once the press got hold of the comment, is how personal transports started to be called threeps. I never liked the term, but no one ever asked me for approval, so...
Janice Massey.
The president broke down. Just broke down and collapsed, knees first, to the floor. Mario started toward him, but Margie said no, and went to him, kneeling and holding him and stroking his hair, talking softly into his ear. For a minute or two it was strange that here was this machine, this robot, or whatever you want to call it, kneeling down and comforting the President of the United States. And then, after that minute or two, it stopped being a robot and the president and became just a wife holding her husband, telling him that she loved him.
Rebecca Warner.
It was a beautiful and unexpected moment. It really was. And because I am who I am, while I was standing there watching this gorgeous, moving moment, I had to fight not to burst out laughing. Because the one thought that was going through my head over and over and over was, "Holy shit, we're gonna make so much money off this." And we did.
Irving Bennett.
I was invited to the White House press conference by White House Press Secretary Adrian McLaughlin, which was unusual and which annoyed our regular White House correspondent. But when you're told you should be at a press conference by the White House, at the White House, you go. I was there, and I noticed a number of other science and technology writers and reporters from other organizations, so I thought that we might be getting one of those occasional space-related announcements, like we're going to go to Mars or something, which never pans out, and especially wouldn't pan out now, because we were spending so much money on Hayden's. Then the president comes out, and I noticed that for the first time in nearly 2 years, the man actually looks happy. He's smiling, he's waving to the press corps, and he looks like he's actually slept, which is also something that hasn't happened in 2 years. He walks over to the podium, looks at us like the cat that ate the canary, and before we can even sit back down, says, "Ladies and gentlemen, the First Lady of the United States of America." And in walks this golden robot, who strolls over to the podium, gives the president a hug, and then stands there, hands on the podium, and says, "So how do I look?" It was the first time I have ever heard complete, utter, dead silence at a presidential press conference. And then 10 seconds later, we were all yelling at the top of our lungs, trying to get questions in.
Rebecca Warner.
The First Lady's press conference was huge for us, that's obvious. But it was the follow-up press conference with Chris Shane 2 weeks later that really sealed the deal for our company. You really can't beat a child's first steps happening because of your invention for making a good impression on the public. We filed patents immediately, and since we hadn't taken any HRIA funding, we didn't have to accept the statutory rate when other companies came to license the technology, which they did immediately. Charlie and I were billionaires by the end of the month. I bought Greenwave from my dad, finished up or bought out remaining outside contracts, and then converted the building over to making personal transports. Sebring Warner was the first to market and the biggest name in the market from then until now. I wish Charlie had stuck around for all of it.
Summer Zapata.
Charlie Sebring is probably the classic example of a personality unsuited for success. What he was interested in was the work, the design of the personal transports, not all the politics that eventually swamped the pure joy of engineering that in the few interviews he gave, he said he had felt. Sebring Warner went from being a two-person shop to the cornerstone of an emerging industry almost literally overnight. Rebecca Warner navigated it just fine. She was born to run a company. Sebring was less fine, and everyone I spoke to who knew him said it was remarkable just how quickly the pressure of overnight success and fame got to him. Within 6 months of the First Lady's press conference, he became something of a recluse, sending in his work by email and avoiding everyone but trusted friends. 6 months after that, he told Warner he wanted out and sold his interest in the company to her at a substantially discounted rate, which, to be fair, only meant he was a billionaire a couple of times over rather than several times over. 6 months after that, he took his own life because he felt hounded by family and friends who he thought were more interested in his money than him. His suicide note was 5 words. I thought I was helping. Well, he did help. But there was everything else around the helping that drove him down. The irony is that the one person who did the most to let those who were locked in free themselves from their isolation was the one person who ended up the most isolated and alone.
Part 5. The New World.
Josephina Ross, author, The Undiscovered Country, Haydens, and Their World.
Most people don't know this, but the word robot comes from a 1920s play by Czech author Karel Čapek, in which humans create artificial people as workers and slaves, and eventually those slaves revolt and replace the humans as the masters of the earth. The robots in the play weren't mindless automatons or just machines like what we call robots today. They were artificial people with minds and, ultimately, desires of their own. They were, in fact, very much like how people with Haydens syndrome became once they were outfitted with their personal transports. And this presented the world, finally, with the robot revolution that it had always imagined, through science fiction and through all those films where the machines, sooner or later, tried to displace the humans. Only this robot revolution wasn't about replacing humans. It was returning humans who had been lost to their rightful places in robot bodies. It was a peaceful robot revolution, and that was something almost no literature, from Čapek forward, had ever prepared us for. So it's not entirely surprising that, at least at first, it was rough going.
Terrell Wales, Haydens syndrome patient.
You noticed the looks, but at first you really didn't give a damn, because in my case, after a year trapped in my own head, I was able to walk and talk and see and touch things again. You could have made my threep look like a 200-pound sack of manure, and I wouldn't have given a crap. No pun intended. So yeah, I noticed the looks, but I didn't care. I was out. And anyway, at the start, people would stare, but they would smile and ask to take a picture with you, or take a picture even if they didn't ask, because threeps were new and still a novelty. For a couple of months there, it was like being a minor celebrity, like a character actor on a TV show or something. Then after a few more months, there were more threeps around, and everyone got used to us. It's like, yes, you're a robot, okay. Move out of the doorway so I can get into the store. Which was fine, too, because after a while, being a minor celebrity is a little annoying. I think people started to be annoyed with threeps about maybe a year or so after I got mine. Like this. You go out with your friends, and let's say you meet at a coffee shop. Well, the coffee shop is crowded, and people are looking for somewhere to sit. And they see you sitting with your friends, and they think, that thing's metal ass is taking up a chair I could use. I remember the first time I was out with friends at a restaurant, and someone asked if they could take the seat I was sitting on. I stared at her like she was asking to strangle my cat, and I told her I was using it. She said to me, but you're not really here. You shouldn't need it. I told her to fuck off. She must have complained to the manager, because the next time I went there, they had a sign saying that threeps had to give up their seat if asked by a human customer. Get that. A human customer. I left and didn't come back. But soon enough, it was standard practice at most places. If you were a threep, you lose the seat.
Evangeline Davies, Counsel, American Civil Liberties Union.
I was just starting at the ACLU when we got the first queries from Hayden's about these incidents, where they were being made to give up their seats to able-bodied people, and there were even a couple of municipalities that were passing ordinances to the effect that people with personal transports were, in a sense, second-class citizens. You would think that would be an open-and-shut case with regard to the Americans with Disabilities Act, but there were some wrinkles we had to consider. For example, someone with a personal transport who goes to a restaurant isn't going to eat there. Their body is somewhere else, being fed something else. In effect, that person is a free rider, taking up space and, some shops and restaurants argued, costing them money. They argued they had a right to ask people in personal transports to free up space for paying customers. For another thing, if the personal transport is made to stand, is the person controlling the personal transport actually inconvenienced? They aren't being physically inconvenienced because their body isn't there. Having the personal transport stand won't tire out the person controlling it. The argument could be made, and was, that asking personal transports to stand was no more inconveniencing to them than requiring able-bodied people to wear shoes. You could argue it's humiliating to make someone stand when the rest of their party is sitting. The bars and coffee shops could point to groups of able-bodied people crowded around a single table, some standing and some sitting, and say that none of them were being humiliated. And so on. In one sense, these seem like trivial things to be worrying about or to take to court, but they were actually hugely important. Almost overnight, the world had developed what really was a new nation. A group of people whose commonality of experience was unlike anything anyone had ever experienced before. There were roughly the same number of Haydens in the U.S. as there were religious Jews, more than the number of Muslims. They experienced the world in a unique way, and because of how they present to the world, either in personal transports or as online avatars, they will experience things that no other people experience in quite the same way, including violations of their rights. We and other rights organizations had an opportunity that we hadn't had before, to trim off discrimination before it developed. I think in the end, we were more successful than we expected, but less successful than we'd hoped.
Terrell Wales.
When I was a kid, I watched a documentary about the movie Planet of the Apes, the first one with Charlton Heston. They were talking about how they would make up all the extras as various types of apes, like chimps and gorillas and orangutans, and then the extras would go to lunch and they would segregate. All the people made up like gorillas would sit with other gorillas. All the chimps would sit with chimps. It started being like that with other Haydens. Whoever you were before, you started being this other person too. Someone who none of your other friends could imagine being. It wasn't their fault. They just never went through the process of being trapped in their own skull and never knowing if they would ever talk to anyone ever again. I suppose maybe it's like being in a war. You had to be there, and eventually you start spending all your time with the people who were there because they knew what it was like. I would see other threeps on the street, and we would do a wireless handshake with each other, where we would send each other our addresses as we walked by. Later on, we would sign on into the Agora, the first version of it, the one that was like a quest-oriented video game, without the quests, and find each other and just hang around and talk. On the Agora, we had avatars that looked like our bodies did when we were healthy. Hardly anyone faked their image at first. And you could be yourself, or something close enough to yourself that it felt normal. I'm not sure when it was that I started thinking of myself as a Hayden. It snuck up on me. I think it started when I realized that no matter how much I tried to pretend that looking like a robot didn't mean anything, it did mean something, in the way people thought about me and reacted to me. Not just about whether I could take a seat at Starbucks, but whether people treated me like an actual human being. I had some drunk son of a bitch break a beer bottle over my threep's head once, because he wanted to see if it would hurt me. I had to keep from breaking his nose with my metal fist, which I knew would hurt him. I think I finally knew I was a Hayden one night when I went out with a bunch of high school friends to a bar, and they were just sitting there drinking and bullshitting each other, and I was sitting and bullshitting with them. But what I was really doing was checking into the Agora and making plans with friends there to run a game with them as soon as I could get away from my meat pals. Meat pals, meaning people you knew outside the Hayden world. I was doing my time with my meat pals, but waiting to get back to my real world. I'd become a chimp. I wanted to go sit with the other chimps, I guess.
Josephina Ross.
One thing it would be wrong to do is to think of the Hayden community as one homogeneous group, just because they all had the same disease afflict them. In reality, the only thing they all had in common was the disease. Otherwise, Haydens are one of the most diverse communities that ever existed. There are rich Haydens and poor Haydens, educated and ignorant Haydens, Haydens of every creed, color, gender, sexual and political orientation, age, and previous health status. In the United States, at least, the Hayden community was a mirror of society at large. And because of that, there were some immediate schisms in the Hayden community, even as it was realizing it was a community. One of the largest schisms, and one that remains to this day, was the one between the Haydens who spent most of their time in the physical world through personal transports and daily interaction with non-Hayden family and friends, and the ones whose lives were inward-facing into the new world that the Haydens had started to create through the Agora and other spaces and social structures that they'd established. That schism was partially, but not entirely, predicated on age, and other factors played into it as well, like how strong the Haydens' physical world support structure was, as well as certain personality markers. Haydens who were naturally introverted were slightly more likely to spend more of their time facing inward to the Hayden community. The number of Haydens who were entirely one way or another was small, of course, but the general division was real and had a substantial impact on how the community as a whole began to define itself.
Terrell Wales.
The other thing to consider is that after a while the physical world just becomes depressing. Look, in the online Hayden space, I have what you could call a house. It's a permanent chunk of a server that I own. I'm able to build and create there. So, my house is a log cabin in about 6 square miles of virtual Vermont forest. Even when I first got the server space, the technology was good enough that you could walk right up to the trees and you could see all this detail, and all the other sensory data could be piped in.
You could have every day be peak foliage season if you want to.
I did that for about a year once. A creek runs out by my cabin, and I see deer and foxes walk by. It's all gorgeous, and it's all mine. And maybe it's not real, in the sense that it physically exists in the world, but you know what? I sit on my porch and look out into the woods, and it feels real enough. I'm home. And then I have to come back into the physical world. And first off, I have this bloated, pale body that doesn't move. Food comes in by a tube, and then a few hours later goes out in a tube. The body, my body, me, sits in a room piled up with medical equipment and charging chair for my threep. I share an apartment with 3 other Haydens, with a spare room for our caregiver. It's the world's most depressing bachelor pad. And then I go out in my threep, and I never quite forget that I look like a piece of CGI in an old science fiction movie. I mean, you tell me. Which would you rather spend time in? That log cabin in Vermont, or the crappy apartment stuffed with dudes in tubes? Is this even a question?
Irving Bennett.
I filed a number of stories about the Hayden community before we hired Tana Huey, who was a Hayden herself and could report from the inside, as it were. In the early days, when I would give talks about covering the community, the parallel I would give people to describe Haydens was the deaf community. The deaf community is largely invisible to people who aren't in it, but on the inside it has a very strong sense of identity that's informed by the one thing they have in common, their deafness. But within that community, there have always been factions. Those who wanted their children educated in sign language versus those who wanted their children educated in English. Those who saw the benefit of cochlear implants versus those who saw them as a threat to the cohesiveness of the community. Those who wanted to spend their time in the larger culture and those who felt it was important to help the deaf community develop in its own unique culture. The Hayden community was very much the same way, with its own unique variations and spins, of course. But what was obvious from even the early days was that there were some people who saw contracting Haydens as the worst thing that ever happened to them and were desperately searching for a way out of it. And then there were some for whom Haydens was the best thing to happen to them. Suddenly, they had a community and opportunities where they might not have had them before. Their world quickly became everything inside, stepping outside of it when they had to, but only then. For them, being a Hayden was a cornerstone to their identity. Making other people understand that, Haydens and non-Haydens both, was the challenge they had to deal with. Some things were easier to deal with than others.
Loana Dellinger, Hayden Syndrome Patient.
I met Michael at the Agora at a singles mixer. This was early when it was still a little strange to think about dating or relationships between Haydens, not just because of our bodies being locked up, but because often you'd meet someone who was thousands of miles away. But then you'd think, well, why does it matter that we're thousands of miles away? It's not like we're going to go for long walks anyway. So we all got over it. I liked Michael right away. He was funny and smart, and we were both football fans, although I was a Giants fan and he was for the Raiders. I decided I could overlook that, and we started dating. About a year later, he proposed. I said yes. My family wasn't entirely happy about it. I think my mother was under the idea that despite the fact I visited her in my threep every day, I was in a coma of some sort. So Michael was taking advantage of poor defenseless me. My father talked her through it. We had two weddings, one at First Baptist in our threeps and one in the Agora with our Hayden friends. We moved in together at the Hayden residential wing of George Washington University Hospital. After we'd been married for about a year, Michael and I were talking one night about the future and what we wanted to do with our lives, and I said something like, well, before I got sick, I wanted to have kids, but now that's not possible. And then Michael stopped me and said, what do you mean it's not possible? And I started to say something about it, and then just sort of let my mouth hang open. Because there was no reason I couldn't have children, biologically. And there was no reason we couldn't have children. It would be complicated, and we definitely wouldn't be having them the old-fashioned way. But we could have them. So we went to our doctor and said, we want to have children. She looked at us like we had turned into poodles. And finally she said, I think we need to have this cleared. And we said, why? We're adults. We're of sound mind, and my body can carry a child, can it? We started pressing her for reasons why she seemed uncertain. The more we talked to her, the more defensive she got, and the angrier I got. By the time we left the office, I was either going to cry or kill her. But she was just the first. We talked to 5 or 6 doctors about it at the hospital, and none of them would do it. There was no medical reason. I was a Hayden, but I was healthy, and my reproductive system worked just fine. So there had to be some other reason for it. And of course, the reason was obvious. So was what came next.
Evangeline Davies.
Dellinger versus George Washington University Hospitals was a huge case for us in terms of advancing the rights of Haydens.
It was a reminder that, first of all, Haydens were still human beings, with the same rights and opportunities, and that those couldn't be taken away merely due to prejudice or statistically unwarranted concerns over liability. It also, and importantly, forestalled a lot of other cases that we would have taken on. Dellinger raced through the courts, and the decision at the Supreme Court was 9-0. It was a precedent you could hang your hat on. A lot of Hayden-related cases we had settled out immediately afterward. Also, it was the first case I ever got to argue in front of the Supreme Court, so I have good memories there.
Loana Dellinger.
We named our first daughter Evangeline. It was a way of saying thank you. And yes, being Hayden parents to non-Hayden babies was a challenge. It's very hard to describe how strange it is to be in your threep, holding your infant steady while she nurses at your breast. And whether or not we won the court case, we still got lots of looks when we'd take Eva to the park. More than once, we got asked by police to prove she was ours. It took everything I had sometimes to keep from hitting someone. We got flack from Hayden's, too. I get notes saying that because our children were non-Hayden, we were not committed enough to the Hayden cause. And I was like, excuse me? There's a cause? Look, I'd like to help you with your cause and all, but right now, I've got a diaper to clean out. My daughter takes precedence over your cause. Eventually, people forgot about us, which was fine. Now we have two daughters and a son, and my son likes to joke that he has two sets of parents, but one of them doesn't get out much. He thinks the joke is funnier than it is. We're a normal family, really. And I think that this tells you that even in this new world of Haydens, or however you want to put it, there's still people in it just trying to live their lives. That's the real story of any world you live in, isn't it?
Part 6. 25 Years.
Monique Davis.
Does it feel like 25 years? No, but I don't think long stretches of time ever, quote-unquote, feel like however long they are. My daughter was born 18 years ago. I look at her sometimes, and it feels like she was a toddler yesterday. Everything in the past gets compressed together. It's compacted for easy sorting, maybe. But every once in a while, I remember how long it's been. This year's crop of internists includes a doctor who contracted Haydens in the womb. She's smart as they come, and her entire life has been spent in a threep. I think about that, and I shudder. She doesn't think about it at all. It's just always how her life has been. Most of her fellow internists, none of whom remember life before Haydens, don't think it's that unusual either. That's when it feels like 25 years.
Natasha Lawrence.
What bothers me after 25 years is that we still don't have an effective vaccine. We still don't have a cure. What we have are established protocols for locking down the spread of the virus when it surfaces and a whole array of therapeutic machines to mitigate the effects of lock-in. We can't stop the disease. We just make it less awful when it happens. And yes, that feels like a failure to me. In the last 2.5 decades, we've learned so much about the brain. We've made enormous steps in integrating these brain prostheses and have built entire industries around serving Haydens and making their lives easier and more tolerable. And still, every year, hundreds of thousands of Americans get sick with the latest strain of the Hayden virus. Tens of thousands die. Tens of thousands experience lock-in. You know what it's like now? It's like car accidents. Even with automated cars, people still get into car accidents because they try to overrule their auto drive or refuse to engage it. We still lose 10 to 20,000 people a year in traffic accidents. No one thinks of it as an epidemic. It's just the cost of doing business, the cost of living our lives. Hayden syndrome has become that now. A chronic disease of our nation and of the planet.
Thomas Stevenson.
My understanding, or at least the way it was explained to me, was that the Hayden virus is simply a highly adaptable and easily mutating virus. That enough changes about it from year to year and season to season that we simply have a hard time keeping up. One of the questions I had early on was whether this high rate of mutation was something we were seeing in the lab, or whether it might be that new strains were being designed, or at least cultivated, elsewhere, and released into the population. We did see mutation in the lab, but not at the rate we would expect for the level of mutation in the wild. As with so many things about this virus, our data was ultimately inconclusive.
Elizabeth Torres.
They didn't catch Margie Hayden's cervical cancer early enough, so by the time it had been diagnosed, it had metastasized into her liver and her lungs and brain. And I remember very clearly what she said to me. She said, "This is a victory, Liz. I lived long enough to die of something else completely." And then she laughed. I thought it was her lighting a candle, rather than cursing the darkness, if you know what I mean, but that night, I understood what she meant. It was a reminder that the disease that she gave her name to, the disease that defined her in ways I know she wished it hadn't, was not the only thing about her life. She lived long enough to die a normal death. Now, maybe that wouldn't mean anything to anyone else, but it meant something to her. Hayden's did give her one small blessing. Her personal transport allowed her to see people and be seen right until the end. She never tried to hide what was going on with her physical body. But by then, people were so used to her being in her threep that she was able to use it to say goodbye to the people who were important to her, and not trouble those who didn't want to be troubled. It made it easier for her to make it easier for others. And that was Margie all over. When we laid her down next to Ben, I knew she had come to her happy ending.
Duane Holmes.
Nothing ever gets forgotten in Washington. David Abrams never forgot getting stuffed by President Hayden over the HRIA, and as soon as Hayden was out of office, he started trying to get it trimmed back. A program here, a research initiative there, divots to the HRIA attached as riders to farm bills, the usual things. Sometimes he'd get something defunded, sometimes he wouldn't. He was in a safe district, he could take his time about it. By the time he switched over to the Senate, he'd gotten some real momentum behind scaling back the HRIA. He campaigned on it, and he almost got the Senate behind him. But then Ben Hayden died, and at the funeral, Margie Hayden started talking about the HRIA as her husband's enduring legacy. And that was pretty much that for Abrams' first try. It'd take him a couple more tries before he could get enough traction in the House and Senate to cut it down. But he did. The HRIA has been replaced by Progress with Prosperity, whatever the hell that means. Dave Abrams is enjoying his moment as the people's champion. He's lowered their taxes, which always plays. I mean, that's how Hayden got elected in the first place. But if you got Abrams alone with three or four drinks in him, the truth would come out. He got the HRIA defunded because he hated President Hayden's guts. End of story.
Rebecca Warner.
The HRIA didn't have to end, not in the stupid way it did. And it wouldn't have ended if the government would have allowed us to open sales of Threeps and other companies, their neural networks, to non-Hayden syndrome patients. The argument always was that implanting neural networks was too risky for people who were not already locked in and had their brains changed by the virus, and that the HRIA could only be funded politically if Threeps and neural networks and everything else were medical devices. Well, I always thought it was bullshit, and I wasn't shy about saying that. We had all sorts of people wanting neural networks and Threeps, people who could benefit from them. People who were neurotypical but paralyzed, older Americans. I had 80-year-olds yelling at me to give them Threeps so they wouldn't be trapped in their nursing homes. And I wanted to give them Threeps. But as long as we were taking the HRIA money, we had to play by their rules. Money you know you will get is worth more than the money you might get. It's that simple. But at the end of the day, Haydens are still only a few million people. There's a multiple of more senior citizens in the United States. Set them up with a threep as part of their Medicaid package, and we'd have another boom economy overnight. The Abrams-Kettering bill is the worst possible way to move from federal funding to private enterprise. We have almost no time to prepare. Our customer base is stranded because the federal funds they had incorporated into their budgets aren't there anymore. We have no customer base outside the Haydens, and the cost of R&D for designing products for new potential customers is going to kill us. I've never been ashamed to call myself conservative, and I don't mind having the HRIA go away, but it should have been done intelligently. You don't crater the economy just to make political points. It's going to be a tough few years. We'll have to see what happens now.
Heng Chang.
If you ask me what the most surprising thing was in the last 25 years, I'd say it was our discovery that the neural nets didn't just allow Haydens the ability to use computers and body prostheses, like personal transports, but that they could, under very specific conditions, also allow one Hayden to actually overlay their consciousness on another's, in the same brain. We discovered by accident, and it doesn't have any value for most Hayden's patients since their bodies don't move. But then we discovered that a small percentage of people who recovered from the second stage of the virus had their brains changed enough to do it too. That's how we got integrators, the people who can carry other people around in their heads. Here in the lab, the word we used to describe it at the time was spooky. It was spooky. Even now I have a hard time imagining what it must be like to be an integrator. I understand how it works, technically, but I don't feel it.
Terrell Wales.
This sounds funny coming from a man who spends a lot of his life inside a robot. But the moment I really knew I was living in the future was when I got a chance to use an integrator. There aren't many of them, so the NIH puts you in a lottery, and if your name comes up, you get a day. My name came up, and I got ported in, and then, for the first time in years, I was in a full-fledged, no-bullshit, functioning human body. You want to know the first thing I did? I went to the International House of Pancakes and ate so many damn pancakes and sausage links, I just about made the integrator throw up. Then I had an ice-cold Pepsi. Then I had a cigarette. I don't think I should probably say what I did after that. I'm not entirely sure it's legal. The weird thing? Well, weirder thing, is that all the time I was running around with the integrator's body, he's in there with me. And I wondered, what the hell does this guy do when people are using his body? Doesn't he get bored? I'm pretty sure every Hayden who gets to use a real live human body does what I did, which is to eat, drink, and get laid. Except for the last part, it must get monotonous. Also, because I'm sure I almost made him puke, I wondered how often that happens, right? Someone pushes the integrator's body to an extreme point. I didn't wonder about it too much, though. I was on a clock, and I had things to do. But yeah, of all the things since Hayden's first hit, that was the one that made me think, wow, things really are different. And weird.
Chris Clark.
Well, my life hasn't changed a damn bit, to tell you the truth. I'm still not eligible for parole for another 5 years.
Irving Bennett.
When I retired from the practice of journalism and started teaching instead, I began using Hayden syndrome as an example of the fact that, sooner or later, everything simply becomes daily life. When Hayden's first struck, it was the most important news story of the century. Everyone knew it. Everyone felt it. But then it just became part of the fabric of the American story, day in and day out. Something commonplace. Something quite literally quotidian. The half-life between story of the century and not even the story of the day is quicker than you would ever guess. But then I ask my students, does this mean that it stops being a story worth telling? and I say to them, the real journalists among them know the answer even before I ask the question, and the answer is that the story is worth telling every day. The trick is not to find the story of the century. You won't miss that story when it happens. No one will miss it. The trick is to find the story of the day, and for that day, make whoever reads it or hears it care about it so intensely that it doesn't leave them. Then it becomes a story of their life. Maybe even the story of their life. Some of the students look at me like I'm trying to pull a fast one on them. Others don't even care. But in every class, there's one or two who get what I'm trying to tell them. They're who I'm teaching to. They're the ones who, after they leave this place, are going to go out in the world, take a look at Hayden's or whatever, and discover there are still so many stories there yet to tell. I'm looking forward to those stories.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Lock-In, a novel, written by John Scalzi, narrated by Will Wheaton, with a bonus novella, Unlocked, narrated by Bronson Pinchot, Kate Udall, Jay Snyder, Mark Boyette, Lauren Fortgang, Tavia Gilbert, Jennifer Van Dyke, Luke Daniels, Christina Delaney, Lamise Isak, Carol Munda, Scott Aiello, Aaron Moon, Oliver Wyman, Elizabeth Rogers, Stephen Bell Davies, Therese Plummer, Joe Barrett, Dina Perlman, Allison Johnson, and Kristen Rummel. Executive producers Steve Feldberg and Mike Charzik. Producer Bruce Katovich. Music by Michael Whalen. Mixed and mastered by Darren Vermas. Copyright 2014 by John Scalzi. Unlocked, an oral history of Hayden Syndrome, copyright 2014 by John Scalzi. Production copyright 2014 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.